In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Vietnam, the war, and the anti-war movement. And our guest is David Marinus. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post, and we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his recently published book. It's titled They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. And what he has chosen to do in trying to deal with the larger stories of the war and the anti-war movement is to focus on two events that took place on adjacent days in October of 1967. One of them was a battle that took place in Vietnam, in which a group of American soldiers was ambushed by a much larger force of Vietnamese. 61 American soldiers were killed, among them the battalion commander. The other event took place the next day in Madison, Wisconsin. As students there were engaged in a violent confrontation with police sparked by the appearance on the campus of a recruiter for the Dow Chemical Company. This was the chemical that manufactured both napalm and Agent Orange. We'll talk more about these two things and perhaps what they tell us about the war, what we can learn by looking back on them, as we talked this morning with David Marinus. And of course, questions, comments are welcome. As I mentioned, he is an associate editor at the Washington Post, won a Pulitzer for his reporting for the Post, also is author of some other books that were both well-received by critics and sold well, one titled When Pride Still Mattered, The Life of Vince Lombardi, and the other First in His Class, and that's a biography of Bill Clinton. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are always welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief so that we can get in as many as possible. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Marinus, hello.
Hello. Thank you, David.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I know you've been spending quite a lot of time over the past few weeks traveling and talking about the book. And I'm glad
I got home last night and got some sleep, so I'm ready to roll.
All right. Well, first, let's talk about the battle. This, as I said, took place in October 17th, 1967, and involved some soldiers from a very famous, from World War II, very famous infantry division. And this particular battalion was known as the Black Lions. And they went into this situation. It was an ambush. They were overmanned, outmanned, outgunned. A number of them were killed, as I said, including the battalion commander.
Right.
Just talk a little bit about what happened on that day.
Well, this is in the jungle 44 miles northwest of Saigon toward the Cambodian border. It was during a period when the American military leadership in Vietnam was arguing that it could win the war through battles of attrition, where they simply went out and found the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese and killed them, much like General Grant in the Civil War, perhaps. And so this battalion, the Black Lions Battalion of the 1st Infantry, was known for going out on search and destroy missions, and on this morning they essentially got destroyed. For a lot of different reasons that were sort of emblematic of the war at that point. They walked into a three-sided horseshoe ambush, less than 150 men surrounded by a full regiment of Viet Cong of more than 1,200. And one of the great ironies of the whole battle is that the Viet Cong regiment, the 1st Regiment of the 9th Division, wasn't even supposed to be there in that part of Vietnam known as the Long Win Secret Zone. They were starving. They were out of rice. They'd been eating boiled stinkweed for 2 weeks, and they were sort of rummaging through that jungle looking for a rear service attachment group that might have some rice for them as they made their way to another part of that region to begin a battle. So it was all by accident. They saw this American battalion in that area with their helicopters clanging around heavily, as American battalions tended to do, and they set up this trap.
I guess one of those questions that comes immediately to mind is how is it that, you know, the Vietnamese knew the Americans were there? Why didn't the Americans know the Vietnamese were there?
Well, they did know they were there somewhere. They just didn't know where. And they were overconfident. They were at this point, the sort of American mentality was, why won't the bastards stand and fight? They thought that the Viet Cong would do these little ambushes but never have a big battle with them. So they walked into the jungle that morning totally confident that if they encountered any Viet Cong, they would win the battle. And they were tragically fooled.
This project really started on the Madison side of things.
It did, yes. I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin that fall, a naive freshman on the edge of the crowd as the protest against Dow Chemical Company unfolded. I watched the city police arrive on the campus with their riot helmets and billy clubs. I watched as they walked into the building and kids came out with bloody heads and rocks were thrown and shouts of Sieg Heil and tear gas used on the Madison campus for the first time. When I decided that I wanted to do a book about Vietnam, I started with that and then said what was going on in Vietnam that day and found the battle, and then tried to link the two through the actions of President Johnson in the White House during those very days. But it all did start with the first anti-war protest I'd ever witnessed.
So it worked out that way that the protest was going on, and you said, well, I wonder what's happening on this same day in Vietnam.
Pure coincidence. And I found this story, and the story had a certain resonance to me because it wasn't a big story, and it only listed two people who were killed in the battle. One was the battalion commander, Terry Allen Jr., who was well-known because of his father, Terry Allen, Sr., terrible Terry Allen, had been the commander of the entire Big Red 1 division during World War II, had led the division into North Africa and was highly regarded as a soldier's officer with a huge reputation, adored by Ernie Pyle, among others. And the other person killed in the battle, aside from the son of Terry Allen, was a brigade major named Donald Hollander, who I had that name rang a bell with me because he'd been an All-American football player at West Point and actually had been recruited to West Point by an assistant coach there named Vince Lombardi, who was the subject of my previous biography. So I just went to the paper, saw that battle, saw those names, and thought maybe this will fit together.
Mm. Well, I think what's important about this battle, perhaps not so much as a battle in and of itself to the larger war, but what
right.
It says is the way that it was conducted, it says something about where things were going with the war, and particularly how the kind of political pressure that was coming down on the military, and then the kind of pressure that was visited upon everybody all the way down the chain of command that led to this happening. And one, I think, would have to say arguably that maybe that this battle should never have happened in the first place.
I think you're right. And Terry Allen Jr., the battalion commander, was responsible. But as I say in the book, he was under enormous pressure. One of the heroes of the book is one of his company commanders named Clark Welch, who tried to talk Allen out of walking into the jungle the way they did that morning. He thought it was a mistake to go the same way they had the day before and to not to try to do something different. He wasn't heard. And I say the reason he wasn't heard is because of the pressure coming down from above, as you put it. From Lyndon Johnson, who wanted to prove that the war at that point wasn't at a stalemate, which is what the correspondents in Saigon were reporting. From William Westmoreland, who thought they could win the war by just having more and more troops there and win battles of attrition. There were almost a half million troops there on their way to over a half million, and he kept pushing for more. Westmoreland thought that the 1st Division commander, General Hay, was too passive in his pursuit of the Viet Cong and was putting pressure on him to follow them into the jungles more. And all of that pressure was coming down on Terry Allen, so that when his best soldier, Clark Welch, said, be careful, this is a mistake, he wasn't heard.
Mm. Those soldiers who fought and survived this battle,
yeah,
they knew full well that this was a disaster. I think the other thing that's characteristic,
yeah,
about this is the fact that the military, the leadership, tried to spin it and say that it was a victory, that we
absolutely
had won.
Absolutely. I was stunned when I saw the press releases put out by the military after the battle, and also by the accounts of General Westmoreland and General Hay coming up to the base camp afterwards to describe it as a victory. It was a horrible loss. They lied about the body count. And I was able to document precisely how they lied about it. They made it sound like they killed 103 Viet Cong soldiers, and in fact, they just, in interviewing survivors, they'd added up the same bodies 10 times to come to that total. And this was, it was sort of a subtle thing that really impressed me, is how dishonored the soldiers who endured that battle felt by the lies about it. It was almost as though, the truth was what was important to them. They knew what they had gone through, and for the American military to call it a victory and to call it a meeting engagement instead of a ambush, which is sort of a semantic thing in the Army, but important, really forever disturbed and angered the soldiers who survived the battle.
And it seems that there was, as far as the Army was concerned, the leadership of the Army was concerned, the fault rested on the battalion commander, and they said among themselves that, although publicly they recommended him for a medal.
Oh man, that of all the things that I reported in the book, what happened with that is probably riled me more than anything. General Hay, who wasn't at the battle, in interviews later said that if Terry Allen had lived, he would have fired him, and that Allen didn't deserve any medals, but he was given a Distinguished Service Cross only because of his famous father. Then I discovered that this same General Hay, who was not at the battle, who according to all the people I interviewed had shown up far after it was over, and had chewed out one of the soldiers for crying after surviving, who had survived the battle. The same General Hay was awarded a Silver Star for this battle, and the report that gives him the Silver Star is a complete made out of whole cloth. He was, you know, saying things he did that he didn't do.
Well, is it fair to say that this disaster was Lieutenant Colonel Allen, the battalion commander's, the man who was among the killed in the battle, that was his fault?
Well, I think there was plenty of fault to go around. He certainly made mistakes during the battle that I document. But I think that the fault and the anger goes all the way up. For instance, Clark Welch, who was the hero of the battle once it unfolded and survived, He was a true believer in the cause, in his men, and everything before the battle. Afterwards, he went into a deep funk for many decades until I found him, and he was angry. He was angry at Colonel Allen, definitely, but he was also angry at the government that allowed his men to be put in that position and the military brass that allowed it to happen.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with David Marinus. He is an associate editor at The Washington Post. And if you're interested in reading this book that we're talking about here, it's titled They Marched Into Sunlight. And it has just recently been published. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. And what the book does, as I explained at the beginning, is it tries to deal with the larger stories of the Vietnam War and the anti-war protest movement by focusing closely on two events. One, a battle that took place in Vietnam on the 17th of October of 1967, and then a riot that took place on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison the next day on the 18th, as students there protested the presence on the campus of recruiters from the Dow Chemical Company, the folks who made napalm and also Agent Orange. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How is it that in Madison, then, this particular event, the presence of the Dow recruiters there, was the thing that touched off this ultimately violent confrontation?
I think the anti-war movement was changing in the fall of 1967. The war had been going on for 2.5 years by that point. 12,000 American soldiers had been killed, which was, of course, an enormous amount, but 45,000 more would be killed before the war was over. There was a sensibility among some anti-war protesters, by no means all, that everything they'd done to that point had failed and that they had to become more aggressive. So they staged an obstructive sit-in this time, the first of that sort, where they would literally try to stop the Dow recruiters from seeing any students to recruit. And from there, every possible mistake that could be made was made, much like the battle in Vietnam. The the UW administrator, Chancellor Bill Sewell, who was a great sociologist but had no experience as an administrator, actually had opposed the war himself and had voted as a faculty member not to allow military-oriented corporations like Dow to recruit on campus. But when he became chancellor, he felt that he had to he believed strongly in freedom of speech and assembly and that Dow had the right to do it. And he allowed the Madison City Police to, on campus, didn't come up with any creative ways to defuse the situation, and watched in horror as the police marched into the building with their billy clubs upraised and the kids came out with their bloody heads. Some of the police had never had any training in riot control before. Those few that had only been trained by the Chicago City Police, which is kind of an irony when you consider what happened a few months later at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. Many of them were eager to get at these spoiled brat college kids, as they thought, who were protesting a war while their brothers and friends were fighting in it in Vietnam. So there was some of that involved. There was a few protesters who were interested in provoking a confrontation with the cops, and so for all of those reasons, it unfolded in the ugliest way possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just in as you say, in both cases, there are so many points when you say if something had gone differently, the ultimate outcome would be different.
Yeah.
And here, in this particular case, there was the Dow recruiter on campus, and the students decided they were going to occupy the building where the person was conducting the interviews, and so I guess there, in between that decision and the decision to send in the police, that's one of the places you wondered, well, could somehow things have gone differently here? And you had the opportunity to talk with this man who was the chancellor, head of the university, I guess I just really, you're really curious about what it was he thought, what he considered doing. Did he ever just say, fine, go ahead, sit in the building, see what we care, until you're ready to come out? You know, how ultimately the decision got made to say, okay, fine, send in the police?
It was a bad decision. He regretted it, but he froze, essentially. He was paralyzed by the situation, unfortunately. He had no concept that the police might go in there and violence would ensue. But he couldn't think of another way to handle it, largely because it wasn't his interest wasn't in dealing with student protests. He thought, as a matter of fact, when he took over as chancellor, that would not be something that he had to deal with, naively. And so between that time when the students came in and the police came, he froze, and he was haunted by that moment for the rest of his life. I interviewed Bill Sewell when he was 90 years old, still reporting to his office as a sociologist at Wisconsin, and still haunted by that moment, and by particularly one moment as the riot was unfolding, and he was looking out the window from Bascom Hall onto the plaza of the Commerce Building where it was all happening. And one of his sons, a graduate student, rushed into his office and said, Dad, can't you stop it? They're beating the hell out of the kids. And Sewell said, I can't. It's too late. Mm-hmm. One of those moments that lived forever with him.
Do you think that this event had a significance for, in a larger sense, for the anti-war movement in the United States?
Well, I think that events like it had a profound effect on millions of kids. Not necessarily this event for everybody, but I interviewed a lot of students who were freshmen and sophomores that year who said that it was an awakening for them. They'd never seen anything like it before, and it got them to thinking in different ways. But its effect was contradictory as well. There were a lot of people who were turned off by the violence and alienated from the anti-war movement because of incidents like that. So I think it's simplistic to say that it had one effect. I think it had various ramifications, but it certainly represented a turning point. And that's why I focused on October 67. It was after the Summer of Love. The counterculture wave was rolling across the Midwest from the West Coast. Before the Tet Offensive, when the American public's perceptions of the winnability of the war would be forever changed. Right at a moment when everything was up in the air, and the anti-war movement was becoming more aggressive, and this was one of those events that defined that.
Yeah, It's interesting when you think about where this happened, people don't think of Wisconsin as being a hotbed of radicalism. Although, as I recall, I think it was the city of Milwaukee that has the distinction of being the only city in America ever to elect a socialist as mayor. But aside from that, I guess one wonders why this happened there.
Well, the University of Wisconsin at Madison was a very strongly political and anti-war campus. And it had been traditionally. The Wisconsin campus traditionally had more out-of-state students than any other Big Ten school. A large contingent from the East Coast that added a certain yeast to the place. It had a history department with a long tradition of examining America's manifest destiny and role in the world and expansionism. It had the tradition of sifting and winnowing, encouraging dissent. And so for all of those reasons, Madison was indeed a place that something like this might unfold. And Wisconsin, I just learned recently that two of the largest draft riots in the Civil War were in Wisconsin, in Port Washington and Green Bay. Ironically, those riots were involved mostly a young immigrant man who didn't want to fight in the Civil War. And 100 years later, you'd see the immigrants, the second, third generation immigrant working class kids being the ones who fought in Vietnam, and the middle and upper middle class being the ones who didn't want to fight.
Yeah, those were the riots that were touched off by the fact that at the time of the Civil War, if you could come up with enough money, you didn't
exactly
have to go.
Yeah.
So it fell disproportionately on the poorer people who obviously couldn't come up with much it was, a couple of $100 or something like that. If you couldn't come up with that kind of money, then you went.
Yep. And in the war in Vietnam, the draft was also a constant source of conflict and discussion. Whether you had a draft deferment and felt guilty about it, but for every American male who wasn't in the military between the ages of 18 and 25 or 6, you had to think about and talk about what would I do if I got drafted, if I opposed the war. And that certainly added a fire to the anti-war movement in everywhere, but especially in college campuses like Wisconsin.
Our guest again, we're about midway through. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Marinus. He is an associate editor at the Washington Post. He's authored a number of books, one about Vince Lombardi. That book is When Pride Still Mattered. He's also written a biography of Bill Clinton, titled First in His Class. Is the author of The Clinton Enigma and co-author of The Prince of Tennessee, Al Gore Meets His Fate. He now lives in Washington, D.C. And Madison, both?
Well, I'm proud to be able to say that now. My wife and I are from Madison, and last year we bought a little house there that we were living in the summers. So it's great to be back after 30 years away.
All right. And the book here we're talking about is titled They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And again, questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm wondering if there was a particular reaction you've gotten to the book. It would not surprise me. And I know that in the review that he wrote for your paper, David Halberstam kind of raises this question, and that is that by constructing the book this way and setting these two events side by side, the battle in Vietnam and the riot that happened in Madison, that it seems to suggest an equivalency between the experiences of the protesters and the soldiers, and I can imagine a lot of people saying it's just not the same. And I guess I wonder, is that indeed how you think about that, and do you see that there is?
Well, I certainly thought about that long before when I first started writing the book. And as a matter of fact, I had a discussion with David Halberstam before I wrote the book, and he said, he suggested against trying it. His opinion is in the vast minority. None of the soldiers that are in the book have had that problem with it. None of the other characters in it, and very few of the other reviewers, because there's no question that they're not more equivalent events in terms of the danger that the soldiers faced versus what happened to the protesters. That's not the point of the book. The point of the book is to get people who, people who might not read a book about soldiers in Vietnam but are interested in the protest to look at the other side and vice versa, and that has happened to a large degree. And I've had amazing events where, for instance, at the Milwaukee Public Library, someone after my speech said, "How many people here were at Wisconsin in 1967?" And about 30 people stood up. And then, "How many were Vietnam vets?" And another 30 raised their hands, and they applauded each other. It's kind of a naive concept in the divisive modern American culture. But I was trying to get people from those two very different worlds to think and deal with each other. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of the book. If I had just written a book about a battle, it would have just been another book about a battle.
He does, Halberstam does say something interesting, I think, in the review, that I think is insightful. And he writes that, "It's always struck me that one reason the Vietnam War does not go away is that in some ways it is our second civil war, pitting us not only against the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong, but dividing us against ourselves as well." You think that that's...
Some validity to that, certainly. And I think those divisions from the Vietnam War and from the other events of the 60s are still somewhat evident in America all these years later. Really, that's what I'm trying to deal with in the book.
Let's talk with, we have some callers coming in, and we have someone first on our toll-free line in Bourbonnais, so let's talk with them on our line 4.
Thank you for having David Marinus. That year, the same year, is one where I discovered the most appalling statistic, and I went through a great deal of effort at the Pentagon to make sure this is a correct figure. In 1967, there were killed by friendly fire 5,373 Americans. I'll hang up.
All right. Well,
that's an interesting statistic. I don't know that, but it wouldn't totally surprise me. I know it was a large number, and I know that even in the battle that I write about, some of the men were killed by friendly fire. Is, of course, a ridiculous term to ever use. It's nothing friendly about the fire, but by American artillery in the battle killed some of the American soldiers.
And this is accidental.
Accidental.
When your soldier is killed by his own side.
That's, it can happen in a lot of different ways, by misfiring, accidents, and so on. But as I report in the book, the Viet Cong strategy, which they defined allegorically, was to grab the opponent by the belt and hang on. That meant fight as close to them as you can, which made it more difficult for American artillery to not injure and kill its own men as well.
And that was one instance or one reason that even though we had an overwhelming kind of in terms of military hardware, technological advantage, that it didn't work when you were fighting them.
Didn't always work, no, absolutely, because of that strategy and the ambushes and guerrilla tactics.
Another caller here in Chicago, line 1. Hello.
Hello. I was 17 in 1967. I didn't feel any division whatsoever. I felt that the majority of the people, my age or the protesters or even society who stayed kind of neutral, didn't really want the war. I didn't feel any division like there was, like today, there's half for the war and half against.
Where, in Chicago?
Right.
I can't explain why you didn't feel that. I think that in October of 67, the public was starting to turn against the war, and the polls for the first time were showing that perhaps a very slim majority was... turning against the war, but it was a very close call at that time, so it certainly wasn't a...
I don't know why, I just didn't feel it at all. I felt maybe I was too myopic in myself, you know, I didn't... Luckily, I had when they did the lottery, I got a high number, and I wasn't drafted. But I looked at that war with the greatest amount of fear, because there was no animosity against the Vietnam person. I couldn't fathom.
Right. It was far different in that sense from the war in Iraq, where The military aspects of those wars are totally unlike, as are the enemies, but there are still some echoes of Vietnam today in a lot of different ways. You know, soldiers in a place where they don't know who the friend is and who the enemy is. And
well, it is in that sense, but I think a lot of people feel that they're fighting civilians in Iraq. And here's the thing that I'm
that was true in Vietnam too.
That's what I'm saying. But here's what I'm a little disappointed as a baby boomer.
Yeah.
And somebody who was a scared rabbit like everybody that I knew, because really I don't think anybody wanted to go no matter what.
Yeah, self-preservation.
And the fact that the same people are in charge now.
Well, you'd be interested in my book then, because one of the characters in the book is Dick Cheney.
Right.
Who was a graduate student at Wisconsin in that fall of 67. And Cheney represented a type. He wasn't against the war. He wasn't really even for it. He just didn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
And he was avoiding the draft. He'd flunked out of Yale twice and was now trying to get a graduate degree and getting serious about his studies. And his whole mindset was just don't bother me with that. And now he's one of the main architects of this.
Well, a lot of the talk show hosts are in this category.
Uh-huh.
You know, the ones, the pro, like the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys, they all kind of dodged the draft too. So I mean, I'm very troubled by that.
Yeah, because, I understand your feelings.
You know, it bothers me a lot. As somebody who faced it directly, and who are so adamant now to go sacrifice those people.
Well, I'll tell you, the deepest thing I learned in this book. You know, I was coming out of Madison. I was somewhat familiar with that side of the story, but the deepest thing I learned. You know, I'd seen all the movies about Vietnam and read a lot of the books, but it wasn't until I interviewed the soldiers and some of the people in Vietnam who endured the war itself that I came to understand what the horror of what it really is.
I think the interviews will be pretty close with Iraq, too, I think.
Mm.
So, anyway, well, thank you for taking my
call. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. And other comments, questions are certainly welcome. We have about 15 minutes left. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're listening, we're here where we are, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And again, our guest, David Marinus, he's associate editor at the Washington Post, and the book that we're talking about is titled They Marched Into Sunlight. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I think that one of the things that's true about the book, and a lot of people have remarked on it, is just how vivid, how intense your depiction of combat is, and that if you want to know what it's like, one of the things you could do is read it. And I've not had the experience, and I know you haven't had the experience.
Right.
How did you manage to learn about it and get that level of understanding?
It took me a long time, and I had to win the trust of all the survivors of the battle. I interviewed about 40 of them, and also some of the soldiers who fought on the other side for the 1st Regiment of the Viet Cong. But beyond that, I was lucky in that I found a whole stash of interviews taken with survivors of the battle in the days right after it occurred by an Army military historian for a secret report that never really came out about why this battle unfolded the way it did. And so it was a combination of my interviews, deep interviews with people, where I couldn't really trust their memories of the chronology of events, but I could trust details. Like Clark Welch, a first lieutenant in the battle, remembering that he looked down on the ground and saw some blue thing wriggling like a worm or a fish, and he realized that it was his biceps that had been shot out. That's the kind of thing that people don't forget and that you can trust. You know, you can't trust the time, whether they remember the time of events or everybody that was involved. So I would use those details from my interviews with the survivors of the battle, plus the interviews that were conducted right after the battle, which were far more reliable, in my opinion, because of their proximity to when it happened, plus the official documents. And then I spent a few months just sort of using these big old art posters, sort of blocking out where everything was and trying to figure out the contradictions before I wrote those two vivid chapters.
Yeah, it certainly seems that the one overall impression that you come away with is that you would never again think that a battle was somehow planned. Or
yeah,
the,
well, that was
to plan, you know.
Exactly, but the trick for me was to evoke the utter chaos of the battle, and at the same time make it understandable for the reader to follow. Sounds kind of impossible, but that's what I was trying to do in those chapters.
Well, we have some other callers here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, so we'll go next to line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I did read your book, autobiography, I believe, of one of my native sons, President William Jefferson Clinton.
Oh, the biography of Clinton, yeah.
Yeah, Clinton, yeah. Anyway, I would just like to ask a question that may be a little bit far-fetched, but say 20 or 30 years down the road and you happen to have the good fortune of still being alive, do you see sufficient parallels between the Vietnam War and the student unrest as typified at Madison, Wisconsin, and what may be happening in the nascent or emerging Operation Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and the occupation and the unrest that seems to be coming to the fore now, that you can say something like, well, things never change and Americans never seem to learn about past mistakes?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I started this book before 9/11, before the war in Afghanistan or Iraq, and yet I see a lot of echoes of Vietnam already. I think that militarily the wars are very, very different. The way the soldiers are regarded by the country is quite different for the better. But the policies that lead America into situations like this, and sort of, I think that situations change, but human nature might not, which is kind of a depressing conclusion for a historian to come to, but that's sort of the way it appears to me in many respects. You have wars based on rationalizations, at least, that are questionable. I don't think those are the reasons why Vietnam or Iraq started, but the rationalization of the Gulf of Tonkin attack for Vietnam and the weapons of mass destruction, or, as Dick Cheney would claim, a nuclear capability in Iraq, questionable now after the war has started. And you have, in 1967, in October, a president who was determined to show that he was prevailing and that the press was getting it wrong, which is somewhat similar to what you see today. So I think in a lot of ways there are some echoes, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have another caller. I believe this is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to attack the notion that I think was attributed to David Halberstam, that what we're looking at here was a sort of second civil war in America. And one of the most interesting sources for this, or for the analysis of that notion, is a series of polls that the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations has been doing every 4 years since the 1970s. With questions about the Vietnam War, and they're asked, one of the questions that is asked each time is, do you agree with the statement that the Vietnam War was more than a mistake, it was fundamentally wrong and immoral? Now, that was the question people asked to agree with it. The number in 1990, 71% of the general
public
agreed with that statement.
Yeah, yeah.
That it was wrong, not just a blunder.
Right.
It was fundamentally wrong and immoral. But the thing, already in the 70s, the numbers were that high. So we had not so much, a second American Civil War here,
right.
Fundamental division on Vietnam. What we have had since the Reagan years, I think, is a massive campaign to sort of disremember the Vietnam War, where the division is set up. That is, the notion that it is a second Civil War is more a triumph of public relations from the 80s and following.
That's a fascinating concept. In any case, there is a lot of divisiveness a lot of it stirred up by the right wing, as you suggest, about sort of the after effects of the 60s, trying to blame all of society's ills on the 60s.
I think it's part of that. I quite agree. Well, that, as it seems to me you were suggesting a moment ago, becomes an even not just a problem about how we're going to misremember history, but an immediate political problem. There was an op-ed in your paper, as a matter of fact, this last weekend, by a neocon at the American Enterprise Institute and the chairman of the Project for a New American Century, saying, I was amazed, that what we need in Iraq is tactics more like Vietnam. They're calling for it. And that's why it's important, it seems to me, for the impression to be put about that there is this fundamental division on the Vietnam War. In some sense, the people who are promoting the war in Iraq are the ones who are insisting upon it.
That's a very sophisticated analysis, and I appreciate it.
I'll appreciate your book, too.
Okay, thanks.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Again, we have about, at this point, maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. David Marinus, our guest, associate editor to the Washington Post, author of the book They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967, that aims at trying to deal with the two very large stories here of the war and the anti-war movement by looking at two events that took place October 17, 18, in 1967, won a battle in Vietnam, and the other was a riot took place on the campus of University of Wisconsin-Madison. The book is out now in the bookstores. You want to take a look at it. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You had the opportunity, you went back and you interviewed a lot of folks, people who were there in Vietnam, people who were in the command structure, and also people who were involved in the anti-war movement. One of the things I'm curious about is how many of the people that you talked to who were very much involved in the anti-war movement then went on to continue to be involved in politics?
Well, one of the key characters in the book is Paul Soglin, who was a graduate student in history at Wisconsin, sort of in the second or third tier of the anti-war leadership before that event, was in the building and clubbed by police during the riot, and emerged afterwards as sort of a spokesman for the anti-war movement in Madison. 6 months later, he followed the cliched dictum of the times, work within the system. He did. 6 months later, he was elected to the city council in Madison. 6 years later, he was elected mayor of Madison and reelected four times, and served for much of the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. Hmm. So he definitely followed that path. Eventually, in one of those only in Madison ironies, he was defeated last year because people didn't remember his past and thought he was too conservative.
Hmm. It does. I guess the question that it invites is to what extent the anti-war movement continues to be a part of politics in this country, whether people who are directly involved or the kinds of organizing that they did, or the themes, does that current still run through American politics today?
I think it does. I think it's somewhat different because of the lack of a draft, and so there's a little bit less intensity on college campuses or in that age group, but after the Vietnam era, there were so many waves of despair over assassinations in '68 and the ending of the war and Watergate and so on that I think somewhat diminished that energy. It's changed somewhat. Some of the focus went into the anti-globalization idea and that sort of merged to some degree with the anti-war movement of today. I think it's different, but I think that there is a very strong and deep running vein in American politics that carries that anti-war flavor. Hmm.
One more caller I think we'll have in Hoopston on our toll-free line four.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I haven't had a chance to read your book, but I've been very much interested in this whole thing, that what you're saying and what you've written about. And I've had some things that have bothered me all the time, and I still see it in my eyes. That the 18-year-old boys, I saw pictures of the 18-year-old boys in camps and Vietnam girls as young, and truckloads of Vietnam girls as young as 13 being out to service the boys.
Uh-huh.
And then how we reacted to those children that were born out of that unit.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that the first Infantry Division in Vietnam was based at Lai Khe, a base camp north of Saigon. I visited there 2 years ago when I was doing the research for that part of the book a year and a half ago, and I was told that At some one point, there were 1,200 Amerasian children living there, the legacy of the 1st Division after that war, children who were scorned by the Vietnamese and were having difficulty getting into the United States during the Reagan administration. They were gone now, most of them absorbed into this country, but that is one of the...
One of the things, my niece tried to adopt some children. Her husband was in the service, and so we were, there was a whole story about that, how they were brought over and they died and all these different things right here because people didn't know how to work with the children. But the other thing is this that I think is very important. In Chicago, the Northwestern University has, not university, the hospital, it works with the veterans home up there. Now, what has happened, because I know this to be absolutely true, that they're going to tear this home down in a few years and build another big fancy something. But I have veteran friends who can't go there. The only way you can go to this hospital now is to go in as an outpatient, and they have to go way to the west side of Chicago to other places. Now, I have said, doesn't the government believe that we're going to have all of our boys coming back in body bags, or will they be needing these services and in an area where they can be really serviced?
Well, all I can say to that is that the psychological effects of war on soldiers are something that lives with those soldiers for the rest of their lives, and America sometimes forgets that, and as well as the physical scars. Mm.
We're going to have to stop because we've just come to the end of the time. And I want to say again to people who are interested in this story, certainly you should look at the book that we mentioned, They Marched Into Sunlight, just out recently by our guest David Marinus. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He is an associate editor at the Washington Post and has written a lot about American politics. He is the author of a biography of Bill Clinton and also one of Vince Lombardi. Mr. Marinus, thanks very much for talking
to us. Thank you, David. Thank you so much for your great interview. Bye-bye. Bye.